Hello, this is Chip Kinman, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast Network.
History in Five Songs with host Martin Popoff, a production of Pantheon Podcasts. Let's rock out with Martin.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back to another episode of History in Five Songs with Martin Popoff, brought to you by the good people at Pantheon Podcast. We are pleased, as always, to be part of this vast and always expanding Pantheon Podcast Network. Lots of exciting stuff going on at the company these days. We're available on Spotify, iTunes, Megaphone, Amazon Music, 40-odd podcast platforms. All right. So this is episode 204. I'm calling it But For That One Song. I was going to call it possibly Asterisk Songs. That was actually a suggestion of William Walker after we were sort of sharing ideas on this. But I didn't want to call it that because we recently did Asterisk albums, and I didn't want anybody to get the impression, oh, I've heard that one already, because of the similarity in the title. So I'm calling it But For That One Song. But yes, the sort of theme here, by the way, I want to thank William Walker, Mick Phelan, and Derek Tomey. They all gave me some good ideas. I've mixed my notes all over the place, so apologies if I'm citing something that somebody brought up or I'm quoting somebody, but yeah, it's a bit of a chaotic shambles of moving things around. But suffice to say, all three of you gave me some nice suggestions with this idea. So yeah, the idea is I like to do these episodes that are a follow-up on another episode and looking at it sort of a different way. So, But For That One Song, the idea here is that, you know, in that previous episode, we were talking about that one album that stands out and you always have to put like a star by it and say certain things about it. So on albums, when you're rating it sort of thing, right? So on albums, there are always these problematic songs that you always have to point out and always kind of annoys you that you have to point it out. You don't know how to rate it. Is it part of the album? Is it not part of the album? What makes it stand apart? What distracts you? In most of these cases, it's a negative, but it's not always a negative. So yeah, the idea is, you know, and this morphed a little bit from, you know, the original plan was possibly finding that one song that makes an album imperfect and why it makes it imperfect. But it's more turned into a little bit of this asterisk thing, right? This idea of these are songs that kind of, you know, got a little star by them because you do have to point them out and you say, is it really a song? Is it not? You know, how blah, blah, blah. How does it fit? So it's roughly in categories. And then at the end, we've got our usual, you know, honorable mentions, but we've even got kind of honorable mention categories here. So what got me thinking about this episode was I was talking with, I think it was Mark, and I'm going to be going on Mark's show. So we were talking about Ted Nugent and the idea of how that second to last Ted Nugent album was way too short and it had too much jokey stuff on it. And so Ted Nugent is one of these that has a lot of these asterisk sort of songs. And we're gonna point it out as we go along in what categories he falls into. But another one that really always bothered me was Led Zeppelin Coda, right? We were arguing on Facebook about Coda. And, you know, it's an album of rarities, but then all of a sudden there's just a live version of I Can't Quit You Baby on that, which is on one of their albums before. And I don't like the fact that there's Bonzo's Mantra on there too, which is an instrumental drum solo sort of thing. So to me, that one's got two of these asterisk songs that just mess up the concept a little bit, right? So that's kind of the idea. That's actually one of the more shining examples of messing up the concept. I don't have a lot like that. So it's kind of interesting that this episode is almost like there's a lot of categories that I couldn't really fill in, and it would be neat to see on the Facebook if people can point out some of the ways these things fill in. But and something, William, that you had pointed out was that, and it's kind of interesting, is that it's often not just one song, but it's a few, and it points to like a dearth of material, You know, you think of the Van Halen situation with the interstitials, you know, the little pieces. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but, you know, the little instrumental pieces of music that you get in there. We're going to be talking about that as a category as well. But, yeah, kind of interesting that, you know, I guess what we want is we don't want any of these, but for that one songs on these albums where there's this thing that distracts you. We want all perfection. We want all, you know, you wrote all the songs, you played on all the songs, and that's another category coming up that be a bit of a funny one. But okay, so let's kick off with our first one here, and yeah, take a listen to this. This is the Beatles with Revolution 9. Funny, this is a whole nother category that I could possibly do a show on. You know, these songs that you're not sure quite how to say the song title, right? So I had to look that one up. You know, everybody thinks of number nine as it goes in that quote. But so this is one of those really early ones. Again, you know, what have we learned on this show? The Beatles started everything, right? Everything started with the Beatles. They always were the first to do this sort of stuff. Now, maybe you could point out some previous ones, but so this is one, you know, on the White Album where it distracted you in a big way. It made you think, all right, so they're officially out of material, even though it's a double album. It's like, this is really annoying. So this is a song that really got a lot of people talking song. It's basically a sound collage, a noise collage, piece of performance art, maybe you might want to call it. It creeped people out because it is kind of scary. And it really annoyed people and it really got people talking. But so it's definitely a song that stands out on this album. You know, they have other asterisk type reasons for things here too. You've got some guests, you've got, you know, the various vocalists. So there's that kind of thing going on as well. But yeah, so this is just a prime, you know, original, early example of something like this. And the one I immediately thought of right after this is L.A. Blues on the Stooges Funhouse, right? That certainly, well, you know, even We Will Fall on the first Stooges is a little bit of an asterisk song. Here I am using this term. I should go back to But For That One Song. But yeah, so that one's got this long, creepy thing on it. And then Funhouse has L.A. Blues, which is just another big, like, free jazz, you know, John Coltrane or Ornette Coleman, whatever, you know, fusion-y, noisy, Captain Beefheart sort of just pile of noise. So L.A. Blues is like a pile of noise the same way Revolution 9 is sort of like a pile of noise. And one of you guys actually pointed out Bugs, right? Bugs from Vitalogy. And yes, it absolutely fits that as well. It's like a gratuitous piece of what is this? It's really one. It really is one of their best. Brilliant album. Eddie ruins it. It's not really Pearl Jam. It's one person's self-indulgence. So it could be a great example following in the footsteps of Revolution 9. Yeah, so the idea, and I went and played it all and against the other songs. So you've got regular songs, and then you've got this Bugs thing, which is just this bad acid trip sort of thing that's sitting there. And it feels a little bit like that. I think Mick and Derek, you both pointed out My World on Guns N' Roses Use Your Illusion 2 right at the end. It's also a little bit of a gratuitous Axl Rose. Granted, it's not very long, but it's just sort of like a... It's him kind of rapping over kind of like an industrial, you know, backtrack of noise. And so, yeah, it doesn't fit. It distracts. And then that's the other thing that happens with a lot of these songs that drives you crazy. They're trying to apologize to you a little bit for putting this messy little thing on here that now you don't know whether to call it a song or not. But they're trying to apologize to you by sticking it at the end of the album, right? So they're like saying, well, it's part of the album. It's not really. In this case, it's not even that long. It's like, we'll leave it up to you if you think the album's over before this thing comes. So they're also admitting to you that it's not good enough to be in the middle of the album somewhere, right? To like bring it in with the gang, right? The big hug. Okay, this is one of the songs that's part of it. So that's always bothering of these kinds of songs as well. And then, of course, the interesting thing is in the Spotify age, you can go on with a lot of old classic albums and you don't even know where they end because they don't really make it clear that where the bonus tracks start, right? So that happens. So, you know, we've always had that old thing of the Japanese bonus tracks and whatnot. But now you get all those bonus tracks on there and you don't know where these albums sort of end. So there's your intro one. Let's take a listen to our second selection here. This is Deep Purple with Bloodsucker. All right, now that's Bloodsucker spelt B-L-U-D, sucker. So this is Deep Purple redoing the original Bloodsucker from In Rock up into the great album Abandon, which is the second one with Steve Morse, 1998. And it's stuck on the end of Abandon. So the category here is when these bands re-record their old hits and just stick them on there. You know, Deep Purple is kind of guilty of this with sticking like a jam version of Hush from Hook End or whatever on the end of their Nobody's Perfect live album, you know, to like, hey, we got to capture, you know, Richie's back in the band. So this is 88 and 87 material. And then all of a sudden they've got this jam thing on there, which is kind of annoying. But yeah, and Deep Purple's got a lot of these but for that one song situations. You think, you know, I might even argue Get in Trouble with this. Child in Time is a distraction on In Rock. I think of A200, so you go down the instrumental road, so that's kind of a distraction. You know, a category that we're going to call like an honorable mention category, but Mistreated. So when bands do the old rote old blues on an album, that, you know, everybody's got to point that out, and it's like, is it a real song? You know, is an old blues a real song on these classic rock albums? Because it's so based in tradition, it's so half written in the 50s and 40s and 30s, you don't know what it is. So it's just there, it's a space taker, it's a distraction from the rest of the modern material these bands are writing. William mentioned the likes of Anyone's Daughter on Fireball. You know, is that a distraction? Is it in the category of joke tune? So but for that one song. Fireball definitely is a but for that one song album for Anyone's Daughter, because everybody who talks about that will make some crack about Anyone's Daughter on there. It's kind of a jokey country tune on this, you know, serious, you know, modern heavy metal album. But, you know, more directly on this Deep Purple thing, you know, Ted Nugent re-recording Journey to the Center of the Mind. I don't know. It's on Love Grenade or Crave Man, one of those. But, you know, the other problem with Ted Nugent, I mean, it goes even further. I mean, Detroit Muscle's got Star Spangled Banner. You know, that's not a re-recording. But he's got Backstrap Fever on The Music Made Me Do It, which is just a kind of a redo, jokey redo. So it's got two things against it. It's a jokey redo of Cat Scratch Fever. You know, he's got Sunrise and Sunrise Fender in brackets, Fender Bass 6 Solo. He's got Fredbear Acoustic. That's a recording in an acoustic version. That's the other thing that drives me nuts with these but for that one songs is when you've got an acoustic version. Sometimes you've got an acoustic version that's a re-recording of the old song, like the Fred Bear here, and sometimes you will even get, of course, the rock version of a song on an album and the acoustic version on the same album. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, but that's another really annoying thing. So it's like, you know, it really makes you think about that idea of filler, right? You know, another one famously like this that always drove us nuts was Doctor 95 and Lights Out 95, re-recorded versions of those songs that were stuck on Walk on Water. You know, we would have, you know, thinking of how promising and how good a lot of the material on Walk on Water was, this is the much vaunted reunion album with Michael Schenker, we would have liked to have heard more originals, that's for sure, on that. A little down this line, it reminds me, Deep Purple Infinite has Roadhouse Blues right at the end of Infinite, this great album of all this great songwriting with Steve Morse, and all of a sudden Roadhouse Blues. Roadhouse Blues is a really annoying but for that one song album, because it's kind of ruining Infinite, but it also kind of ruins ETL Live by Blue Oyster Cult by having that thing on there. And then for that matter, I think of We Gotta Get Out of This Place and Kick Out the Jams are kind of a big mar on Some Enchanted Evening. A lot of people are not big fans of that Some Enchanted Evening album because of that, especially We Gotta Get Out of This Place. Diamond Head on Borrowed Time, this album with not very many songs, not great recorded. All of a sudden, they're re-recording two songs from Lightning to the Nations on there. Pretty weird. So that really compromised that. You almost felt like it was an overlap album, almost like a greatest hits, re-recorded hits album. So that was always annoying. Pointed out here, apologies, I think this might have been William that mentioned this. Arthur Brown's recent Monster Ball, which has a re-recording of Fire on it, but it's far from being a perfect album at all. The best example I could find was a re-recording of Please Don't Leave Me that John Sykes did for his 1997 solo album Loveland. So there's that category. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back. All right, back again here on History in 5 Songs with Martin Popoff, episode 204, but for that one song, let's take a listen to our next track and we shall discuss. This is Kiss with Then She Kissed Me. Okay, so the category here, this is a major overlap with an earlier episode way back, actually. Wow, 131, that long ago, dubious cover versions. So the idea here is that, with a twist on it, the twist from that episode to this is the idea that this is really a distraction. We're not talking about, it's a little twist on the word dubious. It's the idea that it really is a distraction. You think it wasn't a great idea. And in this case, again, we're back to that idea of putting the song that we're kind of apologizing for by putting it at the end, right? So this is a cover of the Crystals, gender reversed, right? 1963 single, Then He Kissed Me. So this is Kiss doing a 60s kind of girl group cover thing. But everybody kind of points this out. Derek Williams, Mick, I think maybe even all three of you pointed this one out when I asked for examples kind of thing, right? So this is something that everybody complains about when they talk about the Love Gun album, right? And other ones like this that always drove me crazy. The Cult Electric is such a perfect album, but it's got the Born to Be Wild cover, and for that matter, Riot and Rita. Derek Tomey mentioned, it was a big deal for them. It did well, but Cars, the cover of Cars, Gary Numan on Fear Factory Obsolete. And I mentioned definitely before, The cover of Highway Star on the Metal Church album sticks out like a sore thumb and is a distraction, and that album would have been much better without it. I mean, not to mention that it's not a very good cover. These boots are made for walking on, Killing Is My Business. Mick Phelan also mentions, Nuclear Assault. Yeah, Led Zeppelin's Good Time, Bad Times. So out of place, they stuck it on the end of Handle With Care, Desperate Stab at Gaining Mainstream Listeners, Megadeth, the Kings of This, They Do Not Need to Cover I Ain't Superstitious, and Anarchy in the UK. Absolutely. I feel like these novelty covers, they feel out of place. They feel like they have a purpose, a corporate purpose. They feel like they have a single purpose. They feel like they're attention getters. And another thing, again, when you do a cover, it does make you think that you're stupid. You don't have enough of your own material, right? You're not smart enough to have enough of your own songs. You don't have anything to say, so you'll cede territory to let somebody else say it for you. So, yeah, you know, Rocky Mountain Way, these, I think, were also pointed out by William. Rocky Mountain Way, oh, man, I hate that song, period, but I hate it on Rock and Roll Machine by Triumph for sure as well. And also, this falls into that category of the dumb automatic sleepwalking blues song, right? So it's this idea of these bands saying, "Oh, we want to remind you of our roots in you know the British blues boom or whatever." And so you get these songs. I mean, I even feel AC/DC The Jack is a little bit like that, but they gussy it up by making it a funny song. But you know, Night Prowler, whatever on Highway to Hell, same sort of thing, right? Is like that as well, where. Yeah, and AC/DC's got a few others. A lot of bands do. A lot of bands do this, but this idea of just like putting that on there, and then again, you're going, okay, well, you couldn't write a proper better song. This took no writing at all because most of it's borrowed anyway. So yeah, that's always really annoying. You know, along this line, Train Kept a Rolling on Get Your Wings, you know, even though it's a big song and it fits in and it's heavy and all that kind of stuff, not for 1974, it's a little annoying. Shapes of Things on Victims of the Future, Gary Moore, Since You've Been Gone on Down to Earth, so everybody always has to point that out when you're talking about that album. Praying Mantis covering the Kinks on Time Tells No Lies. You know, we talked about the rock and roll medleys on the live albums, you know, and I even think a but for that one song, a standout song that everybody has to mention that is distracting is even getting a new original, Suspender Love, on Tokyo Tapes. But yeah, the Heap has the rock and roll thing. Yeah, Extraterrestrial Live has a little rock and roll. You know, something else another one of these that stands out thing is when Aerosmith kind of broke up the sustained, the sustainability, the energy of live bootleg by putting on that super old live stuff. That was always annoying to me. Girl School doing Tush on Hit and Run. Yeah, so, I mean, we could go on and on about covers. You know, we do have more or less a whole episode on that, so let's move on. Let's move on to our fourth selection. Take a listen to this. This is Queen with Under Pressure. All right, so kind of a messy category here. I wanted to get more examples of this, but I do find as something interesting about Under Pressure. So this is the distraction of having a big guest star on your album, and then Hot Space, of course, is such a compromised album with this, you know, daring sort of dancey, you know, Mac Munich, Musicland Munich sort of sound. That all the whole rest of the album pales in comparison. You've got the standalone song that is a single, and you've got this distracting big star in David Bowie on it. And it's an amazing song. It's like by far and away the greatest song. So it just blindingly outshines everything else on Hot Space, and it really doesn't feel like it's part of the album. And again, the main reason it doesn't feel like it's part of the album is you've got this big, you know, one person distraction in David Bowie, and it's like, okay, did Queen need help to make this album good? Did they need a superstar outside of the four guys? So you're always thinking that with this guest star situation. So, you know, I think of when Alice Cooper guest stars on people's albums. He's on that Twisted Sister thing, right? That'd Be Cruel to Your School thing, called, you know, Recalling Schools Out. So that is a distracting song on that album. You've got Chris Cornell showing up on an Alice Cooper album. You've got Brian Johnson on a Jackal album. I love that album, though. Cut the Crap is such a great album. That's a great song they do, too. What is it? Locked and Loaded, I think it's called. But you've got... Yeah, so a couple other ones here. This is a quote. I think this might have been Mick might have said this. Yes, great ideas. Recent years especially, didn't they? Instead of standalone singles, for example, Radiohead's OK Computer may be the most important album of the 90s period, you guys say, from any genre, yet they tacked on Lucky, a great song. It appeared on a charity compilation in 95. So yeah, this is the separation sort of thing. And 2 years later, it's on the album. So that always felt cheap to me. I suppose Mob Rules and Queens Under... Yeah, so Mob Rules... So again, there's a sort of subtle idea of a distraction of a narrative, right? So you've got the song Mob Rules on Mob Rules, and you know its connection with heavy metal, and then you've got over in the other Black and Blue side of thing, you got Fire of Unknown Origin, and you know two or three or four of those songs were put forward to go on the heavy metal soundtrack. So you feel like there's this distracting element of why these songs are there. So that's kind of the thing. Here's another interesting one that's doesn't quite line up, but it causes these songs to be separated out. I think it was Bill Schuster when we were talking about Blue Oyster Cult, The Symbol Remains one time. I think it's you, Bill. Apologies if not. But the idea of didn't want to go and listen to the advanced singles as they were coming out and everybody was talking about them because he wanted to not have those songs stand out as distractions or but for that one song or, you know, something special about these are different or were they released on their own kind of, right? So I thought that was an interesting idea. Didn't want to sully the experience of the album by hearing, Box in My Head and whatever the other one's called. Ahead of time, and then have them discussed to death and listened to death. So when you got the album, you were bored of those songs already, and they had another narrative. So that's interesting. I felt that happened with Clockwork Angels as well, with BU to B or whatever it is, and the other one. It had two advanced singles that everybody talked about a lot ahead of time, and even it goes back to Stick It Out. I think I either did a whole show on advanced singles or I've been planning to for ages. But yeah, that's a funny thing where that song always feels like, okay, I'm already sick of it. And so it stands apart from the rest of the album. So the album is diminished to me by a song or two. We just went through this with Metallica 72 Seasons as well. Weren't there four? I think there were four advanced songs from that one. But back to this idea of the big guest stars. You've got Tony Iommi on the Megadeth album. You've got female vocals on Megadeth albums. You've got Kate Bush on Don't Give Up, which separates it out. Run for Cover, Gary Moore. You've got glad he's there, but still, it makes these songs feel like Gary couldn't do it on his own a little bit. But you've got Phil Lynott on Military Man and Out in the Fields. You've got Glenn Hughes sings, I think, three songs on there. Going back in time, you've got the distraction of John Anderson being on Prince Rupert Awakes on King Crimson Lizard. You've got Ebony and Ivory, Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder on 1982's Tug of War, plus what's that you're doing? So the single of that overshadowed everything, and the fact that it's a duet. As soon as you got a duet, you got the messiness is like, what is the band? Who is the band? You know, sometimes these singles come out and there's Paul McCartney, ampersand, so it's now a duo situation. So do you believe it's part of the album or not? Do you talk about it as part of the album? So that happens. I think of Monkey Time, The Tubes, with Martha Davis. I didn't know this. So I when I was doing research for this, I guess there's the Martha Davis version of Monkey Time. And then there's also the one with Michelle Gray, one of the Tubes' principal dancers, right? So I got to go listen to that. But apparently there's two different versions of that. But again, the whole duet situation makes that song kind of sit apart from the other ones. All right, let's move on to our fifth selection. Take a listen to this. This is Black Sabbath with Orchid. Okay, again, I love Orchid, I love Embryo, I even love Solitude, but causes me to be a little annoyed with, like, do I call Master of Reality the heaviest Black Sabbath album. It's so heavy, but for these three things that are really super, super quiet. So that's a weird one, right? But this also falls into the, the debate about, is an instrumental a real song on these albums? And then, is an instrumental a real song on these albums when it's just one guy playing it? So is it even a band? So you've got the, is it the band situation? There's no vocals and no singing and no lyrics, right? So is it compromised because of that? And then you get into the, Embryo is 28 seconds long. Orchid, I think, is a minute and a half. So, how short does a song have to be to not be called a song, right? And yet they're named songs, and we know that whole story with the, publishing, and you gotta name a bunch of songs. That's kind of funny. And this came from the idea of, it was suggested by one of you three guys, Black Sabbath changes. And I didn't want to go down that road of just like the mellow song on these albums. But the interesting thing about changes that makes me feel like it's one of those but for that one song, is the idea of when you have alternate instrumentation that isn't part of the band, regularly. So here you've got piano. It's mentioned, I think William mentioned the writer on Mechanics, maybe this was Mick, an absolute bomb, but when you're thinking it's a good classic UFO song in a heavy form, they throw in a bunch of horns, and that's how they open up the album. So, it's annoying when you hear horns, when you hear classical, right? When classical goes onto a song, you go, okay, that's not the band, so is this really part of the album kind of thing? And this goes down the road of these, like I say, these short instrumentals. Black Sabbath has a bunch of them. You think of FX as well. Stonehenge. What else? There's one on Tear, I think. Van Halen is notorious for doing this. Van Halen has those asterisk songs with the joke songs, the short songs, the instrumentals. They have the covers. So they have... Almost every album has something that annoys you in that department. Less so in the Sammy years, right? Mentioned as well was, again, I didn't want to really go down this road, but the folky tunes that Budgie throws in, are those real songs? And again, you can bring up the debate, are they real songs when they're really short, right? Especially they tend to put these short songs up against these super long ones, right? So that happens. In this category of these instrumentals that you wonder, are they really songs? Kiss love theme, right? I think this is William mentioned these. In Trance has Nightlights, Black Sabbath Tear. Yeah, there you go. Battle of Tear, UFO Obsession has Arbory Hill. Manowar's debut has Battle Hymns. Painkiller has Battle Hymns. Gamma One has Solar Heat. Testament Souls of Black has Beginning of the End. Tigers of Pantang, The Cage, title track. Saxons Unleash the Beast has Gothic Dreams. Hawkwind, Choose Your Masks. Rick Emmett mentions, yes, true. Rick Emmett throws in these little classical pieces just to show how great he can play classical guitar. So are those real songs? Ravens 3940 on Rock Until You Drop. Hellstars, Unido, Poor Tristeza on Remnants of the War. Candlemass, Spoken Word, Track Dawn, Guitar Solo, I'm Addicted on LA Guns, Cocked and Loaded, Striper's Abyss. Yeah, is Eruption a real song, right? So we always have to say, Eruption, the song. Oh, is that a song? Striper's Abyss on To Hell with the Devil. So yeah, you got a lot of those. And again, you just wonder, how do they fit here? Let's see. So some honorable mention stuff. How long are we here? We're pretty long. Let's leave this stuff maybe for a catch up. But I had I'll just mention this is in a general sense, so we won't go through it. But some other categories that I wanted to fill that bothered me. So these are really legitimate. I just couldn't find a lot of good examples, but live tracks appearing on studio albums, that always is annoying. Even if it's a new song, but I always think of like the live intro to the Dio, the Kings of Rock and Roll, or King of Rock and Roll. That always annoyed me, and it always made that song stand aside for me. When it comes to Dio, I think of, as a mellow song, I think Rainbow Eyes, doesn't fit on Long Live Rock and Roll. So you get those not fitting things. You know, let's see. Moving on to start off just a game. Steve Vai's Real Illusions. This is, I guess, the live track situation. Reprises. That's very annoying. Mentioned as well. You know, when you get a song, you know, maybe an intro or a song, or you get that reprise version of it at the end, and it's always in messy little brackets. It's always shorter. So that's annoying as well. This was a neat category as well. Couldn't find too many examples, but when you're distracted by a song being on an album, but it was on a soundtrack album as well. So you think of Johnny B. Goode, Judas Priest, you think of that Fire of Unknown Origin, Mob Rules situation we talked about. Mention as well, Kiss, God Gave Rock and Roll to You. You know, that really stands out like a sore thumb on Revenge, because you're thinking of this whole narrative about it, right? Richie Kotzen performing Dream of a New Day on Fever Dreams. I don't know much about that one. And the Night Ranger thing, doing Secrets, The Secret of My Success on Big Life. Yeah, I had a whole bunch of examples of this whole phoned-in, dumbed-down blues thing, because I really feel every single time those guys, you know, bands do those, you know, we know Zeppelin's got them, Nazareth's got them, Deep Purple's got them, Gillan, if you believe me, Deep Purple Lazy, I've always felt, was literally like, and you know the clue is when you do an interview or you hear these guys talk about it and says, oh, it's a jam. Oh, we're going to do a jam, you know, live or whatever. As soon as you hear that word jam, it basically means we haven't written a song for this. We're just going to fill the record with some space here. Yeah, I had various examples of joke tunes. I thought Wango Tango, Terminus, El Dorado, you know, Yellow Submarine was brought up by you guys as a joke tune that doesn't quite fit on Revolver. It you know, undermines what you think of that. Huda King on All Shook Up, kind of bothersome as well. I had another category of Don't Let the Guitar Player Sing, you know, when you get somebody in the band singing who's not supposed to be the singer. So that song always stands out like a sore thumb. You've got the Joe Perry songs when he's singing on Aerosmith albums. You've got Nicky Wire, the Keith Richards ones. I like Keith Richards, but mentioned here is Virgin Killer, Near Perfect album, but Uli sings Hellcat. Mick Jones singing Woman, Oh Woman on Foreigner's debut. Robin Trower singing Crucifixion Lane on Procol Harum's A Salty Dog. That's another whole category of this thing as well. All right, that's enough of that. So the whole theme was these albums where you have to talk extra and it annoys you about these certain songs on these albums. You don't know whether they count, how much they count. They screw up the rating. They make the album not good, usually a negative thing. There you go. If you like this show and want to support future episodes, go to Ko-fi.com, rhymes with coffee, ko-fi.com/MartinPopoff. Hit that red support button. Buy me a coffee or a pint. This week, I would like to thank David Block, David Fisher, Michael Gendelman, Carl Isaacson, David Moore, Augustin Garcia de Paredes, Steve Polari, Brian Sager, and Wendy Tipton. Thank you all very much. Go to martinpopoff.com for all your book needs. Of course, we've got the Contrarians video show as well, and you can see me on Sea of Tranquility every week, every Friday on, what does Pete call that? Friday Funhouse? Friday at the Funhouse? Something like that. Anyways, every Friday morning, those things usually go live at 10 or 11. And yeah, lots going on at the Contrarians. We're doing these shorts as well. Grant Arthur's got us really, fired up about some new ideas with the Contrarians. But there you go. Go play some of these albums. Come over to the Facebook and give me some more examples of songs that just kind of wreck your mood on an album. You know, albums that have one song that wrecks your mood. Talk to you later.
Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at the RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at R&R Archaeology.